This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello there. It's great to have you with us today. I'm Joel Hilliker. This is a very uncertain time globally. A lot of people are trying to figure out what is going to come next. They're trying to prognosticate and forecast and determine where the world is headed in the months ahead. What will the global economy look like? Which nations will be stronger? Which will be weaker? Well, looking at things humanly, it's virtually impossible to answer these questions at this point. There's so much up in the air. In our first segment today, we're going to look at how often men's predictions of the future have failed. Some of the smartest, most prominent people in the world have made some spectacular errors in trying to forecast world events. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this. It's a wonderful illustration of why biblical prophecy is so invaluable. It shows you the long-term trends to watch for to get an idea of how current events are going to unfold. In our second segment, we'll look at Israel's judiciary. Israel has been caught in a political quagmire for at least a year, and a major reason is the rise in power of the nation's judges. One commentator said the country has effectively been transformed from a parliamentary democracy governed by law into a judicial tyranny, a bunch of lawyers with radical political views. We'll talk with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about some fascinating history to show how Israel got to this point and how it parallels the war that's taking place within America's government between elected officials and the deep state. Then we'll look at Libya. This nation has been embroiled in civil war ever since Muammar Gaddafi was ousted in 2011. It's a complicated situation, but the internationally recognized government looks to have made significant ground recently against the Libyan National Army. And the reason is it's getting significant help from some key outside sources, including Turkey, Iran, and recently even Germany. All of these nations play major roles in end-time Bible prophecy. We're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Warren Reinsch to help us understand this situation and to give an idea of how prophecy says the situation could play out. And I'll conclude the program today with a word about how to handle adversity and why it's important sometimes to keep wrestling, even when you're in pain. We'll start, though, by taking a trip through the graveyard of failed geopolitical forecasts, and our tour guide is Jeremiah Jacques.
So many centuries after the creation, it's unlikely that anyone could find hitherto unknown lands of any value. Those are the words of the head of the Spanish Royal Commission. He wrote them in the year 1486, advising King Ferdinand to reject an exploration proposal by a certain Christopher Columbus. And here's another quote from British Prime Minister William Pitt the Younger. In early 1792, in order to justify drastic cuts to Britain's military, he said, quote, "Unquestionably, there was never a time in the history of this country when we might more reasonably expect 15 years of peace than we may at the present moment." One final example here comes from Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. In 1964, he told representatives of capitalist nations that socialism would inevitably conquer capitalism. "The future victory of socialism is as certain as the rising sun," he said. These were all highly educated, well-informed, powerful individuals making earnest predictions about the way global affairs would play out. And they all got it precisely wrong. An entire new world of hitherto unknown lands laid over the horizon. Just weeks after Pitt's speech, decades of war broke out, and Soviet-style socialism died about 30 years ago. When individuals try to predict the future, they get it wrong, as those examples show. But it's not just individuals that fail in this area, but also entire schools of geopolitical thought. Back in the early 1990s, after the Berlin Wall fell, leading to the collapse of the Soviet Union and to the end of 4 decades of Cold War, a theory took root called the end of history. This was first articulated by U.S. State Department official Francis Fukuyama, and the thesis stated that mankind had attempted all plausible types of government, and a clear winner had emerged: Western liberal democracy. This represented the end point of mankind's ideological evolution, the final form of human government. So the West had won. The continued spread of liberal democracy, individual freedom, and popular sovereignty was inevitable. The sun would set on authoritarianism, and the era of great powers warring against each other was over. That's what this theory said. U.S. President George H.W. Bush espoused these sentiments, and so did his successor, Bill Clinton, and it became a prevalent view among analysts and policymakers across the West. U.S. military, economic, and cultural power was at its zenith. The spread of Republican democracy was certain. And so because of this belief, many Americans kind of lost interest in the rest of the world, and they drifted off to sleep, thinking that the world's borders were now permanent, and that we wouldn't see much happen to change the post-Cold War order, because history was over. Political observer Kishore Mahbubani said widespread belief in the end of history theory caused the West to go on autopilot, and it did a lot of brain damage. During these autopilot days, the 9/11 terrorist attacks hit America like a bolt from the blue.
What are those people going to do?
Then a few years later, Vladimir Putin's Russia invaded the former Soviet nation of Georgia, bringing a huge chunk of its territory back under Moscow's control. Then Putin's 2014 invasion of Ukraine and annexation of the Crimean Peninsula was even more dramatic. Many Westerners couldn't believe their eyes. U.S. President Barack Obama was apparently in denial that the end of history forecast had failed. After the annexation of Crimea, he said, quote, "Russia is on the wrong side of history. In the 21st century, the borders of Europe cannot be redrawn with force." But Russia had just redrawn them. Secretary of State John Kerry seemed equally perplexed by how history could still be happening in an age when it was supposed to have ended. He said, quote, "It's really 19th century behavior in the 21st century." Meanwhile, the Arab Spring and Ukraine's Orange Revolution failed to achieve their pro-democracy aims. The Syrian civil war mutated into proxy battles between major powers. India and Pakistan locked into a nuclear standoff. Iran and Saudi Arabia engaged in proxy war in Yemen. Iranian zealots systematized their terrorist chaos. And around the world, populism and authoritarianism returned with a vengeance. It turned out that history, tangled, unjust, retrograde, violent, ugly human history, did not end in 1989. Another very popular theory about how world events would turn out could be called the China fantasy. President Clinton talked about this in 1993, saying, quote, "The more we bring China into the world, the more the world will bring change and freedom to China." Clinton's Republican successor, George W. Bush, echoed those same sentiments in 1999, saying, quote, "Trade freely with China and time is on our side. Economic freedom creates habits of liberty, and habits of liberty create expectations of democracy." This forecast was popular throughout the 1990s and even into the early 2000s. Western business moguls and politicians of all stripes believed China's integration into the global economy and its increasing prosperity would cause the nation to liberalize its repressive and authoritarian political ideologies. They believed the ruling Chinese Communist Party would be forced to adopt responsible domestic and international behavior, and eventually even democracy. A truly free and democratic China would benefit the whole world. That was the belief, and it prompted Westerners to pursue all kinds of policies of engagement with China, including welcoming it into the World Trade Organization. By 2010, China had grown much stronger and richer, but barely freer. Then in 2012, Xi Jinping became China's leader, and he began reversing what minuscule reforms the nation had made before him. Xi used China's increased strength from engaging with the West to tighten the Communist Party's stranglehold on the nation, and to boost his own power to staggering levels. He clamped down on the media and silenced activists. He disappeared hundreds of human rights lawyers and thousands of dissidents, and he detained more than 1 million Chinese citizens in concentration camps. He nixed constitutional term limits on his rule, clearing the way for him to control China for the rest of his life. And he made clear that in international trade, China served only the interests of the regime, viciously so. His desire to protect his own power also led to a cover-up that ended up unleashing the coronavirus on the world, which devastated global economies. So the China fantasy foresaw the dynamics exactly wrong. Chinese integration into the international system did not liberalize China. Instead, it only generated greater authoritarianism, a more tightly closed political structure, and a far more vengeful and powerful enemy of the West. In the late 2000s, as it was becoming clear that the China fantasy was collapsing and that Beijing's rising power and geopolitical ambitions were cause for concern, America began to look for help in constraining the dragon that it had awakened. India, with its military and economic power, its geographic location, and status as the world's largest democracy, and with its historic rivalry with China, looked like the perfect nation to help the U.S. In order to fashion India into a security counterweight to China, the Bush administration began selling the nation prized nuclear technology. Arms control advocates decried this decision, but the prospect of having a strong India as a democratic bulwark to China was too enticing, so the sales proceeded. In 2008, the Obama administration continued this courtship, expanding U.S.-India ties and further boosting security cooperation. Western optimism for the theory abounded. It was perhaps best articulated by the Heritage Foundation in 2011. They wrote, quote, "The complex challenge presented by a rising China will inevitably drive the U.S. and India to elevate ties and increase cooperation across a broad range of sectors in years to come." End quote. But in 2014, China's main partner, Russia, made that unlawful annexation of Crimea. That not only showed that history had not ended, but it also showed where India's loyalties lay. President Obama said the nations of the world were largely united in viewing Russia's annexation as illegal. And after all the Bush and Obama administrations had done to curry favor with India, the expectation was that the Indians would back the U.S. position. But instead, India shocked the world by joining its voice with China's and supporting Russia. In the years since then, India has increasingly defied the West and leaned toward the Russia-China axis. India has joined the China-led Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It has purchased huge quantities of Russian weapons in violation of U.S. sanctions. And it has conducted a series of military exercises with Russia and China. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has also held a series of personal meetings with Putin and Xi, which the diplomat called, quote, a signal of monumental change with regard to the post-Cold War status quo. With each one of India's weapons purchases, war drills, and meetings, it becomes clearer that the India counterweight theory has sunk. In recent decades, numerous other hypotheses, theories, and models trying to predict the future of world events have come into vogue. There was the moral consensus theory, the oil imperialism model, the hypothesis of voluntary unificationism. There was also the import substitution industrialization theory, the democratic peace model, the neo-Ottomanism and Islamic democracy hypothesis, the Russian reset, and the list goes on and on. All of these have become popular views of how the future will unfold, and all have been subsequently discredited by the course of actual events. They've all been buried in the graveyard of failed geopolitical forecasts. So it's clear that even mankind's best and brightest minds consistently fail to foretell the course of global affairs. But there is someone who reliably reveals what's coming. In the Bible, Isaiah chapter 46, verses 9 and 10, quote the Creator God making an extraordinary statement. He says, I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Unlike men, whose prognostications usually age like milk, God knows precisely what is on the horizon in global affairs. He can say something, and then thousands of years later bring it to pass. And in the Bible, which is his instruction manual for mankind, he offers a remarkable amount of detail regarding specific nations in the modern day and how they'll interact with each other. He gives us a guide to end-time international relations. A student of Bible prophecy would never have bought into the India counterweight forecast because Ezekiel 38, using ancient names for modern India, shows that the nation would ultimately partner not with the United States, but with Russia and China. A prophecy student also would not have believed the China fantasy, because the Gospel of Luke, in chapter 21, reveals that during the times of the Gentiles, which is the end-time era when China and other non-Israelite nations dominate global affairs, men's hearts will be failing them for fear. So China is not a nation whose rise should have ever been hastened and celebrated. A Bible prophecy reader would also have avoided being lulled to sleep by the end of history theory. Numerous Bible passages forecast a third world war that will be fought with nuclear weapons and that will make all mankind's previous wars look like playground skirmishes. Matthew 24, 21 through 22, in the New Living Translation, state, for there will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began, and it'll never be so great again. In fact, unless that time of calamity is shortened, not a single person will survive. This future war will be by far the bloodiest chapter in mankind's history, and in the lead-up to it, major historic events such as 9/11 and Crimea should not catch us unawares. This passage shows us that history is far from over. A study of the Bible shows that one-third of it is prophecy. Around 90% of those prophecies concern our modern age. So tomorrow's news about the U.S., Britain, and Israel, the nations of Europe, the Middle East, and Russia, China, and India has already been written. These prophecies are inspired by the omniscient God, and their accuracy is stunning. Numerous specific prophecies have already come to pass, proving both the existence of the Almighty God and that the Bible was divinely inspired. And these fulfilled prophecies should give us faith in the accuracy of the forecasts that have not yet happened. The God of the Holy Bible keeps his promises, including his prophecies. He is a God who follows through. In his booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury discusses this aspect of God, writing, quote, "God is the originator of prophecy. He has a deep prophetic understanding that no other being has."
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The political gridlock in Israel reflects an alarming disruption in the democratic norms of the Jewish state and a transformation into a judicial tyranny ruled by Israel's own deep state. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So we hear about the deep state in the United States. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he has talked about a deep state in Israel as we're seeing this election crisis unfold and trying to form a government and all of that, that there are moves by the high court in Israel to really make it difficult for Prime Minister Netanyahu. That's certainly what he has been saying. Tell us how much truth there is in those accusations.
I think it has been on display for Israelis in a way that is quite stark, given when referring to the most recent election and just showing the fact that we have a prime minister that did receive the most votes that he's ever received, his party, and his bloc received the most votes out of any bloc, and yet in the process towards forming a coalition, it looked like the odds were stacked against him by the opposition parties that had the backing of the Supreme Court, in that the opposition parties were going to gather together to enact laws that was going to prevent Prime Minister Netanyahu from forming a government because he's currently under indictment. And that just means that you've been accused of a crime. And so the other parties, with the support of the Supreme Court, were going to try and get a vote to change the law in this intervening period that would say that if you are indicted, even if you're not guilty yet, if you're indicted, that you cannot form a government. And there was really a lot of moves by the High Court to ensure that this vote could take place, even though it was interfering in the Knesset function and really breaking Knesset protocols and laws and acting in a way that its jurisdiction does not allow. And it really did become very obvious to Israelis at that point just how much power the Supreme Court has right now, and has its power to really impact the Knesset and the elections, the two things that really the people should dictate. The people should dictate who rules over them, and that should be done at the legislative level. And then the Supreme Court should come in and decide whether the laws that are created by the legislature, that the people's house, whether they fulfill the laws on the books. And yet we just see the High Court being so much more involved, and in every way it seems that it's involved in a way that is going to hurt the Prime Minister, never help the Prime Minister.
And it's hard to look at any of these moves that it's making as anything other than being directed specifically against the person of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, I mean, the laws that were going to be created, that aren't now, but they were going to be created, they were specifically directed against the Prime Minister and for the Prime Minister. And the High Court, you know, we've talked about this before, but they actually dictated to the Speaker of the House of the Knesset, "You shall have a vote on this now," vote of the Knesset Speaker, so that the law can come about and can be voted on by the Knesset, which is totally out of its purview and never been done before in terms of Israel's history. And the whole point of this was to have a vote to remove the sitting Prime Minister. And so it is, and what's also added to that as well, just another really interesting factor here, is that one of the laws of the Knesset is that one of the Knesset committees can dictate who gets to run in the election, which political parties get to run in the election. And one of the parties that the Knesset committee continuously says breaks Knesset laws or breaks Israeli law to run is the Joint Arab List, because several members of the Joint Arab List, they deny the Jewish state's existence as a Jewish state, which is one of the specific laws that should forbid them from even running. But the Knesset committee has been continuously overruled by the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says no, it's against the human dignity of those Israeli Arabs to not be represented, and so we are going to allow them to run. And so they, in order to get these laws passed that were going to oust Netanyahu, the court was going to force the vote, but then the number of votes that were needed would have to include the Joint List. And so a group of politicians that shouldn't even be there, that are only there because the High Court has overruled the laws of the Knesset in the past. And so this was just an intrusion into the Knesset and into the People's House time and time again through this incident of trying to select the prime minister, which is still ongoing in Israel.
How did the court gain the power that it has today?
It's really interesting to look back on this, and it is something that goes back a good 35 years, or almost 35 years now. There were plenty of changes that were made in the late 80s inside the court that allowed it to have more power. These were changes that were done under the leadership of Aharon Barak, one of the presidents of the Supreme Court. I think he came in the early 90s, but he was still there in the late 80s. Under Shamgar, who preceded him. And a couple of laws that were changed, or a couple of things that were changed, was that the High Court at that point changed the ability of which cases that it would hear. Normally, the policy of standing means that you have to be directly affected by a law that was created in the Knesset to then bring a petition to the High Court, say that I was wronged in this way, and so can you please look into it? And this prevents a lot of cases coming before the High Court or the Supreme Court, wherever you are in the world. And it also prevents the High Court being able to motivate petitions to come to the court itself, and so that it could arrange a petition of something that it wants to strike down from the government. And so in the late 80s, they did away with standing. Basically in Israel, which is very different from most other places, anyone can petition the High Court to look into a matter, which is kind of crazy. That doesn't happen many other places. So that was changed. Also, what was changed is the issue of justiciability. This is what the court can actually hear. Normally, sometimes you'd have a case that comes before the court and the court says, there's no law on this. And so we can't judge this case. If you want me to judge this case, go to your representative in the legislative body and get them to pass a law, and then we will judge the case based on the law that they passed. And in the late 80s, you had the High Court just saying that when there was a gap between the laws that the Knesset produced and the cases that were being petitioned towards the court, that the court would have a greater purview to look into the greater reasonableness of the law and see whether there was extreme unreasonableness in the law and whether they should act. And so they were kind of acting on laws that didn't exist at that point. One of the biggest changes, though, and the change that has really codified the High Court's ability to act lawfully, as it would see it, inside cases to strike down the Knesset. And this is the two laws that were passed in 1992. They were called basic laws, laws of human dignity and laws of occupation. And these are laws that Israel doesn't have a constitution, a formal constitution. It has a series of basic laws that have been passed over time. And when these two laws were passed, they were generally thought of at the time in 1992 as just a more of a moral stance of what we are like at the state of Israel. We believe in democracy. We believe in the fundamental democratic rights of Jewish rights. We believe in human dignity and things like this. The people that voted on these laws in the middle of the night didn't expect that they were voting on a a constitutional element, an element that then the High Court could then use to then strike down future laws from the Knesset. And so there was less than half the Knesset, more like a third of the Knesset, that was there for the passing of these two laws. The person that brought these laws up said that these are not constitutional laws in the sense that they're going to pass power to the High Court to strike down further Knesset legislation. That was even stated. And yet, as time went on, 2 and 3 and 4 months after these laws were passed, the Supreme Court judge, Aharon Barak, came out and said that indeed we do have a constitution, and this constitution was just given to us by these two laws that have massive scope. They are defined by generalities that look after the needs of the state of the citizens of Israel, the general. One of them just talks about how everyone is entitled, every human is entitled to their own human dignity. And so you've got this vagueness that surrounds this law. And Aharon Barak said it was our responsibility to explain to the people what human dignity means in certain cases. And so if you want to, then the Knesset will come along and they want to put a law forward. One of them that was struck down on this law very early was the fact that the state of Israel did not want to accept spouses of a spouse of an Israeli into the country from an enemy state. Say an Israeli citizen married a Palestinian from outside the country, and that's an enemy state. There should not be an open-ended law which says that they have a right to come and live in Israel. That should be on a case-by-case basis. The court came along and said, no, every Israeli citizen has a right to family life. And so that spouse that lives in Israel has a right because family life is part of human dignity, because they deem it so. And so then it could strike down the law of the Knesset and say that, no, anyone can come into the country if they're married to somebody. That's just one example. But what's really interesting about this is over time, Israelis have accepted the notion that the Supreme Court can work inside this gray area and it can act underneath this umbrella of human dignity to invoke the laws that it see fits that govern society, the social norms, if you like, social norms that the Supreme Court justices believe are true and right. That is how they're going to adjudicate the cases, on what they believe societal norms are.
Yeah. You know, just listening to this history, it reminds me so much of what you've seen in the United States. And we, for a long time, it seemed like under more Democrat presidents, that you had more judicial activism within the judiciary branch on the federal level, even on the Supreme Court, where they were essentially overturning what the legislative branch was doing, and they were taking these little wisps of language that they found in the law, and they would contort them to suit whatever purposes they wanted. And that was happening more and more now. It's interesting, in the United States, under President Trump, there's been a fairly strong turn right to more of a constructionist view on the part of the federal judiciary, and judges who are just trying to basically let the law do what it's supposed to do. We haven't heard so much about activist judges in more recent years. We've been talking more about the deep state in the administrative branch, that basically the executive branch, all of these administrative bureaus and these unelected officials within all of these different aspects of the executive branch, that deep state. It's different, say, in Israel than it is in the United States, but you see the same kind of a trend where you have these unelected officials who are basically doing whatever they want to do. They feel justified because they know what's right, whether or not the people agree.
Yeah, it is interesting for sure, because both you have a different variety of deep state, if we could call it that, because both unelected officials, whether you're in the executive branch in the United States or the judiciary over here, both of those groups are unelected. And they have a different procedural process over here, but put simply, judges pick the judges over here. And so you have this perpetuation of judges picking judges that believe a similar type of judicial activism as the judges before them. And so it perpetuates itself inside the Supreme Court. Of course, you don't have the executive branch over here in Israel because it's a parliamentary democracy rather than a republic. You have the legislature that changes, and as that changes, you also get a new prime minister. But you still have the same style of people acting inside the deep state, the elites of society, and those that inside the media, or the educated class, all of them form this same deep state in Israel. That's the same deep state that you see in the United States. And it is interesting also, because if you go back to the time period if you talk about judicial activism in the United States, who was so supportive or who was so against that was Robert Bork, the justice that was refused entry to the Supreme Court back in 1987, even though he was extremely qualified. And he was refused entry because his character was assassinated. Because he was an originalist, he believed in how the Constitution was written, that the frame is understood. And they didn't. They put the words there, and they were very specific in the words that were put there. Well, he's come out as being the most firm critic of Aharon Barak, the guy that revolutionized the Israeli court. And even this even got more press back in 2007, I believe it was when Elena Kagan was made her way to the Supreme Court, because she came out and said that her favorite judge of all time in terms of the way that he reviews cases, the way he acts, was Aharon Barak. And so you have the judicial activist in Israel being the mentor for one of the Supreme Court judges, who then rolled through all these cases, be it the homosexual marriage cases and things like that of the Obama administration. And you see these links to this all over the world. It's not just in the United States. It's not just in Israel. It's also in Canada. It's in Australia. And even in Britain, you see this activist wave of judges take place, entrench themselves into the judiciaries in the early 2000s and in the 90s, which is just really fascinating to see how this has taken place. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, has been watching this and talking about how it was part of a simultaneous policy to weaken the nations of biblical Israel, of which Israel, the state of Israel is, United States and Britain, they form part of the biblical nations of Israel. And really, for the past 30 years, there has been an attack on law at the highest levels. And that is still playing out in Israel. There is a little bit of a difference in Israel, I would say, is that the people themselves, they really do have a respect for the high court. They feel like if the high court says it, that's what they should follow. They trust in the high court and the justices there. They'll readily say we have the best judges in the world. And it's like they are... And if you do come out strong against the high court, you will receive a lot of flack. And that's why it's been hard for Netanyahu to come out too strong vocally, because the public, though they don't trust the high court, they're very uneasy when a leader talks down the rulings of that high court. But it seems like, and it doesn't just seem like it, it is the fact that the high court firmly does come on the side of watering down fundamental truths and fundamental biblical truths as well.
Well, we've been talking to Brent Nachtigall about the growing power of the judiciary in Israel. He's working on a major feature article for the next edition of Watch Jerusalem, the Trumpet's sister magazine. If you'd like a subscription to this, go visit watchjerusalem.co.il. You can find the means to get a subscription there, and watch for this article coming up. We'll also put a link to Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law, in the show notes for today's program. That website, watchjerusalem.co.il, go check it out. It'll keep you up to date with the latest political and geopolitical news about Israel, as well as Israeli archaeology. Thanks very much for your time, Brent.
No problem. We'll be right back.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The civil war that has plagued Libya for most of a decade looks like it's taking a decisive turn in favor of the government and against the Libyan National Army. The reason is that it is getting major help from some key outside sources, sources that play a key role in Libya's future, as outlined in biblical prophecy. We'll now hear about this in this report from Warren Reinsch.
The tide has turned in Libya's civil war. The internationally recognized government's counteroffensive, in conjunction with the Islamic militias, has claimed territories and advanced on a key base of operations, threatening to end the four-month siege of Tripoli. Ever since the ousting of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, Libya has been engulfed in civil war. The Libyan conflict is currently split between the internationally recognized Government of National Accord, or the GNA, based in the country's capital in Tripoli in the west, and the Libyan National Army, or LNA, based in Tobruk in the east. Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar, commander of the LNA forces, began his western offensive against the Tripoli government last April. Within only a few short months, his forces had conquered a majority of Libya's interior. However, the Tripoli coastal enclave remained under GNA control. Haftar's battle then began in December as he marched on Tripoli. After being bombarded for nearly 4 months, on March 26th, the GNA announced its counteroffensive against the Haftar forces. This counteroffensive, named Operation Peace Storm, has ironically produced what some are calling the heaviest rocket fire and fighting between both sides since the conflict began. On April 13th, GNA forces announced that it had reclaimed 6 cities and 2 strategic areas of land around Tripoli. The advance continued as GNA forces pushed towards the city of Tarhuna, a key stronghold which acts as Haftar's central command. In the Arab Weekly, Michael Cousins wrote, quote, "For the first time since April 2019 and the start of the LNA's offensive to take Tripoli, the GNA now controls the entire coastal road. This dramatic turnaround is attributed to Turkey's military intervention in Libya's civil war in support of the GNA, and the air superiority played a large part in it," end quote. Turkey's parliament has also approved a security and military cooperation deal with the Tripoli government. And on January 5th, Turkey began deploying Syrian mercenaries to Libya in support of GNA forces. Turkey has also sent Libya dozens of drones and relocated Turkish frigates armed with surface-to-air missiles to the Libyan coast. This combination of drones and missile-armed frigates with the GNA Air Force has given Tripoli air supremacy over the Tobruk forces. And the surge of troops from Turkey has allowed Tripoli to battle on multiple fronts. While the GNA and Turkish forces focus their assault on Haftar's stronghold in Tarhuna, local Islamic militias have been able to continue their advances on the wings. To the west of Tripoli, the GNA offensive in Sorman and Sabratha on April 13th was actually spearheaded by the local Islamist militias. During the fighting, some 400 prisoners managed to escape, reportedly including a large number of Islamist fighters who were freed by the arriving forces. These 2 cities just to the west of Tripoli are now back in the hands of the Islamist militias. To the southeast of Tripoli, the Islamic militias from Misrata regained control of the surrounding territories, wresting them from LNA forces. One of the militias involved in the offensive was Misrata's Steadfastness Front. According to the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, the Steadfastness Front, or Al-Samud as it is more commonly known, formed in June 2015 in support of the National Salvation Government, which has since been disbanded. Now, those familiar with Libya will know that the National Salvation Government, also called Libya Dawn, has strong ties with the Islamic State and the Muslim Brotherhood. After losing the June 2014 elections, the National Salvation Government and its supporting militias invaded Tripoli. This attack led to the signing of the Libyan political agreement, which created the Government of National Accord, which still exists today. And then in 2017, the GNA forces pushed the Islamic pro-national government forces out of Tripoli, and al-Samoud was one of those forces that was banished from the capital. Now, the two former enemies are fighting together against the LNA. Michael Cousins said, quote, "The predominant view, not just among diplomats, but also Libyan observers across the country, is that because of the turnaround, Libyan Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj is now completely in the hands of the Islamist militants, and any pressure on him to break with them or with the militias will be futile," end quote. So since the GNA's counteroffensive began on March 26th, we have seen Tripoli work in unison with the Islamic State-linked Syrian mercenaries from Turkey and Islamist militias who were invading Tripoli only 3 years ago. This seemingly sudden shift was actually long in the works and has the Islamic Republic of Iran written all over it. For the past few years, Iran has been working behind the scenes to supply these Libyan militias with arms. A couple weeks after Haftar began his offensive against the GNA last April, the Tripoli government announced on April 27th, 2019, that it had seized an Iranian ship blacklisted by the United States for its previous involvement in Iranian weapons trafficking. However, the Islamic Republic of Iran shipping director said that the claim that the ship was detained was actually inaccurate. He said, quote, "There is a dispute with the Libyan government about a ship that we are negotiating to resolve, but that ship has not been seized," end quote. The vessel in question was a cargo ship carrying 144 containers, and it was located just off the port at Misrata, home to the al-Samoud militia. A week earlier, the Iranian ship departed from Bulgaria en route to Misrata, but before it was in Bulgaria, it was actually in a port in Syria, which is leased by Iran and linked to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. An LNA spokesman claimed that the vessel was illegally transporting weapons and ammunition to the GNA and militia forces in Misrata. But whatever was carried in the ship still remains unknown. 3 weeks later, a Moldovan-flagged cargo ship arrived in Tripoli after stopping in Turkey. The vessel was stocked full of about 40 armed vehicles, ammunition, and quality weapons, according to the GNA. Al Arabiya News claimed that the shipment was met at port by the al-Samoud militia force. Photo evidence on social media after the shipment showed that these Turkish armored vehicles and other military equipment arrived in the hands of the al-Samoud militia and another radical militia called the Tripoli's Marsa Brigade. More recently, The Telegraph reported that a Lebanese-flagged freighter left Turkey on January 24th with a shipment of ACV-15 amphibious armored combat vehicles and anti-aircraft cannons en route to Tunisia. However, in classic Iranian fashion, as it approached Tunisia, the vessel turned off its transponder and arrived in Tripoli, Libya, escorted by two Turkish warships. A later investigation, after the crew members related these details, discovered that two other vessels had arrived in Libya with armored personnel carriers after turning off their transponders. These shipments of military equipment have enabled the GNA to conduct its counteroffensive and to regain control of the territory lost to the LNA. Weapons trafficking and supporting local militias are Iran's specialties, and it is the principal way that the Iranian regime exerts its power. As fighting between the two sides continues, and the Islamic militias are rising in power, Iran has found itself in an ideal position to take advantage of this civil war. While Turkey and Iran are often enemies geopolitically, they have also agreed to work together in Libya because they both support Islamist governments. Right now, Turkey is the primary supporter of the GNA, but Bible prophecy says that Iran will lead this radical Islamist resurgence, not Turkey. So we need to continue to watch for Iran to begin to take a larger role in Libya. And if the GNA and militia forces manage to push the LNA out of their stronghold in Tarhuna, the LNA could find itself in a considerably weakened state, one which is unable to continue its Western offensive. And that result could see the empowered Islamic militias in Misrata and Tripoli praised for supporting the government during its civil war, and either being permitted to exist or even invited into the government, just like Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Shia militias in Iraq. Such a scenario would see the establishment of a radical Islamist stronghold on the Libyan coast, giving Iran a foothold on the Mediterranean Sea, well positioned to attack Europe's soft underbelly.
Thank you very much for that, Warren. It's quite a dramatic turnaround with the government there seizing back control. It definitely seems Turkey has a big role to play, but you see Iran as the most important player here from a prophetic perspective.
Correct. There's really a unique thing that Iran is doing right now. They have this certain specialty where wherever they're involved in the Middle East, wherever they're trying to exert their power, they usually do this by supporting local militia groups. They did that in Lebanon. You can think about Hezbollah when the Lebanese civil war was going on. Israel had to come in because there was a lot of terrorist activity that was spilling over into Israeli territory. And this Hezbollah militia rose up and started to attack Israel. And Iran threw its support behind Hezbollah. And then after the civil war was over, Hezbollah was seen as this great hero for, you know, attacking Israel and for regaining sovereignty for the Lebanese people. And they were really seen and praised. They were seen highly and praised as well. The same thing has happened in a lot of different areas. You think of Iraq, the militias there, Iran has supported them. And during their war against the Islamic State, after that all happened, the Shia militias became the heroes. The same thing happened where they were praised because they fought against the Islamic State. They freed the Iraqi people from the grips of the Islamic State, and they were brought into the government, and they were allowed to exist. They were brought into the military. And, you know, this could be a very similar circumstance here in Libya. It follows the exact same pattern where Iran is supporting these militias. They are giving them arms. They are giving them training. There was a report back in June last year where a couple of Mossad agents found two Iranian officers trying to go over the border from Tunisia to Libya. And these officers were supposed to be training these Libyan militias. So it's the same circumstance. And if, as I mentioned in the article and in the report, if the GNA is able to push back at the LNA, regain control of this key stronghold in Tarhuna, then it's very possible that the Libyan militias would be praised for supporting the government.
Last Friday, we were talking with Richard Palmer about Germany sending troops in to help the situation. They're supporting the GNA. Generally, we see Germany and Iran on opposite sides. What happens here if Germany is supporting the same government that Iran is supporting? How do you see that playing out?
Well, obviously, I think that's a huge conflict of interest. Europe is a very Catholic and Christian continent, and obviously the Middle East is mainly Islamic. But Germany has its interests in Libya. It wants to be able to protect itself because, the southern Europe is very vulnerable in some ways. A lot of people call it the soft underbelly of Europe. And they're not going to allow a terrorist regime to be set up, you know, on their southern coast right there in Libya. So because you have the GNA currently, really close with Turkey and with these Islamist militias, with Iran allowing these ships to come in and to offload weapons to these militias, that really does create a conflict of interest where I think what's going to happen down the road is Europe is going to ask or even force the GNA to choose between either Iran and the Islamists or between Europe and European help. Right now, Berlin's only, committed 300 soldiers to help, so it's a very small number. And the EU is providing funding for the Coast Guard, but that's just the start. And Bible Prophecy talks about Europe coming through and sweeping through, passing over these countries. And one of those countries is going to be Libya. So we know eventually Europe is going to have to sweep in there with more and more control, more and more troops.
A very complicated situation, one that we definitely need to keep our eyes on. It's interesting how these two main parties in end time biblical prophecy, Germany and Iran, are converging on this one piece of real estate there in northern Africa. We certainly appreciate you bringing that all to us, Warren. We've been talking with trumpet writer Warren Reinsch about Iran's inroads into Libya. He's written an article about this. You can find it at thetrumpet.com. It's called Libyan Civil War Intensifies Opportunity for Iran. Go check it out. Thank you very much, Warren.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
What do you do in tough times? That's an important measure of a man. The Bible's verdict is clear. Proverbs 24 and verse 10 says, "If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small." We have to be tough. Toughness is a defining virtue. As Rudyard Kipling put it, you have to build the capacity to force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone. God wants to build that toughness in us, but he requires that we chase it down. His esteem for this quality is clear in many biblical examples, and perhaps the starkest is that of Jacob, who literally wrestled God himself. I heard a lecture recently that made use of this example, and it is an excellent one. The Bible doesn't give us a lot of details, but it's clear from the account in Genesis 32 that Jacob found himself in a midnight grappling match that lasted into the morning. Wrestling even a few minutes is exhausting. This contest apparently lasted for hours. And at last, this man, who was actually a God being manifested in the flesh, put Jacob's thigh out of joint. Yet as painful as that injury was, somehow Jacob summoned the will to keep fighting. Imagine wrestling with your hip out of joint. What Jacob did here demonstrated incredible tenacity and toughness. Just think about the fact that God deliberately threw out Jacob's hip and then kept wrestling with him. Clearly, he wanted to measure Jacob's character. And finally, this divine being said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." Jacob's response revealed his recognition of his respect for the superiority of his sparring partner. And it also showed the full measure of his own resilience and grit. "I will not let you go except you bless me." That's what Jacob said. Now that quality in Jacob deeply impressed God. And it was that quality for which God renamed him Israel. Israel, that name means Prince of God or Striver with God. And this being told Jacob, "Now Israel, for as a prince have you power with God and with men and have prevailed." This whole incident is such a vivid picture of the toughness required to be a part of spiritual Israel. God's people must be contenders, strivers, individuals who will drive themselves to struggle and fight as long as is necessary to attain victory. James 1 and verse 12 in the English Standard Version says this, "Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him." God tested Jacob's endurance and conquering spirit to its limit, and he's testing ours as well. There are times when our trials can become quite grievous. We're grappling with an adversary, and then just as it seems we're at our breaking point, Our hip goes out of joint. Circumstances may seem overwhelming, impossibly demanding and painful. And at those times, we naturally want to quit and just be left alone to tend to our wounds and our injuries. But God demands that we keep fighting. We have to wrestle with unexpected conflicts, with protracted fatigue setting in, even with a hip out of joint. He wants to know how bad we want the victory. In our trials, we need to draw on God's power. We need to call on His help. Absolutely. That is critical. We also need to be like Jacob and maintain a dauntless determination in the face of that adversity to never give in, to never faint, to fight, and even to struggle with God for the victory. Develop the toughness, the princeliness of Jacob, the spirit that will say, no matter the odds or the pain, I will not let you go until you bless me. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks a lot to my guests today, Jeremiah Jacques, Brent Noctegal, and Sam Livingston. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And I'll leave you with this thought from Lucius Annaeus Seneca. Just as wealth, however modest, grows through careful deployment if it is entrusted to a responsible guardian, just so our lifetime offers ample scope to the person who maps it out well. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.